I want to talk to you today about the life of Samson. For some time, I have been impressed to study this man's life. I can tell you that this has been a wonderful experience for me. And I hope and pray that in our studies, you too will be blessed greatly of God. Before I begin, I want to recommend some reading that will help you in your studies. Of course, we're looking at the book of Judges, starting with chapter 13 all the way to chapter 16. So it's four chapters. They're very enlightening. We'll look at those issues as we begin to analyze it a little later. Also, you want to be able to study Patriarchs and Prophets, chapter 54, talking about Samson's, entitled Samson's, on page 560 to 568. Also, you want to look at the Bible Commentary, Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, Volume 2, page 381 to 400. Those, of course, dealing specifically with the chapters of Judges 13 through 16. Then, of course, there's Signs of the Times article, July the 1st, 1903. It's entitled Worldliness and Licentiousness, Lessons from the Past. And this, of course, dealing with Samson and also Solomon and so forth. Some lessons to be learned, some very important quotations out of that. By the way, all the references I'm going to be giving to you are taken from the references that I'm recommending that you read. We continue on with the Signs of the Times, but in this particular section that I'm going to be sharing with you, there is a five-part series, and it's so insightful, and I will have to say that there was no way I could quote everything that I wanted to in this lesson of the life of Samson. I highly recommend you go back and read everything that I'm sharing with you, particularly these five articles. It starts September the 15th, 1881, entitled The Lesson for Mothers. Then September 22, 1881, Temperance in the Family. September 29, 1881, The Mother, a Missionary. October the 6th, 1881, An Unwise Marriage. And then finally, the fifth and last article and reference I'm going to give you is October the 13th, 1881, In the Downward Path. So that's just some recommended reading I would ask that you go through and look very carefully in order to help you understand the story of Samson. Now, as I said, his story starts in chapter 13 of Judges. Now, it just so happens that, you know, when you look at the life of Samson and you look at the previous judges, it's an up and down kind of an experience. You have some good judges, you have bad judges and so forth. And Israel goes into apostasy and then, of course, they come out and they're faithful to God and back and forth, back and forth. In this particular case, we pick up the story here in chapter 13, verse 1. It says, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. So here they are in apostasy. We can clearly capture the setting and understanding. I want you to listen now what the servant of the Lord has to say about these things. And this is taken from the September 15th article of Signs of the Times, 1881. I want you to listen to this. The first statement I'm going to read to you, or reference in regard to that, is I've entitled it Mingling with Idolaters. So this is the background setting, really, of the life of Samson and all that was taking place at that time. The servant of the Lord says, "For a period of 40 years, the children of Israel were constantly harassed and at times completely subjugated by this cruel and warlike nation. They had mingled with these idolaters, united with them in commerce, in pleasure, and even in worship, until they seemed to be identified with them in spirit and interest." Now, I'm going to stop right there for just a moment and just kind of clarify a few things here. But particularly this one thing, they mingled themselves with idolaters. We can understand that. They're commingling with them, associating with them in ways in which they shouldn't be. But it says, she says, they united with them in commerce. Now, some people might say, well, there's nothing wrong with, you know, doing business, selling, you know, something to a person that may not be a believer. But look, she's not talking about that. When she says they were united with them in commerce, she means they were in business with unbelievers. And that's a big difference. Look, the Bible doesn't condemn us selling products to non-believers. I mean, you would be out of business if you had to sell only to believers. But the fact is they went in business with, and this is what the problem was, the Jews, the Israelites, went in business with the Philistines. And so this is what caused, one of the issues that caused great problems. She goes on to say, then these professed friends of Israel, meaning the Philistines, became their bitterest enemies. What's interesting is here, they professed to be in the beginning, you know, to be their friends. And once the children of Israel let their guard down and began to compromise and commingled with them on so many levels, then the true nature of the Philistines appeared. And boy, what an object lesson that is for us today. What an object lesson. Just because someone comes to you with, you know, all nice and kind and befriends you in so many ways, doesn't necessarily mean that in the end they will always remain that way. It's not until you can really, they can be tested in relation to the will of God. She goes on to say this after saying these professed friends of Israel became their bitterest enemies and sought by every means to accomplish their destruction. There is still, as with ancient Israel, a constant tendency among the professed people of God to depart from the Lord's instructions and to imitate the customs and practices of the worldlings. The people of the world have given themselves to do the service of Satan, and their hearts are opposed to the religion of Jesus Christ. They may profess to acknowledge him as their Redeemer, but they have the same hostility as did the heathen of old, to that religion which it calls for self-denial and self-sacrifice. And again, that's the real crux of the issue. You know, many people claim to be Christian, claim that Christ is their Savior, but the real test is whether they're going to deny self, whether they're going to be self-sacrificing in their life. So it doesn't come down to profession. It comes down to the practicality of experiencing a denial of oneself to do the will of God. And let me tell you, there's not many people doing that. Not even among those of us who claim to be Seventh-day Adventists. She goes on to say, the spirit of the world today is the same that prompted the rejection and crucifixion of the Prince of Life. The same that has consigned his followers to imprisonment, exile, and death. The Christianity, which will yield to the influence of the world and conform itself to the principles and customs, is looked upon with favor by men who are the enemies of God. Well, of course they're going to be looked upon as favorable, because it's a religion that doesn't cause anyone to think about their morality or the lack thereof. So, absolutely, that's the reason why in many cases Christianity is not hostile in any way to the heathen. She then continues, but when the necessity for holiness of heart and life is presented, then the world feels that its rights are endangered. When the church rebukes fashionable follies, demoralizing amusements, extravagance, and self-indulgence, when Christianity is spiritual, positive, earnest, and aggressive, then the opposition of the world will be excited. Signs of the Times, September the 15th, 1881. So now you're catching the essence of what was happening during the time of the days of Samson. They were compromising. They were worldly. They were yielding to the pagan powers, in this particular case, of course, being the Philistines. And they really had no positive impact upon the heathen world. So this is a very important statement, very interesting. And again, we continue on with the same reference, but in a different part, and emphasizing something very important. And this, of course, has to do with godly fathers and mothers. And I want you to listen to what the servant of the Lord says about this. There were still in Israel true-hearted ones whose souls were filled with anguish because of the condition of their people. So despite the fact that there was so much apostasy and compromising and unwillingness to surrender all to God, there were still those who were faithful. And again, this is a great object lesson. It's something very important for us to remember. You remember that in Elijah, he thought he was the only one who's standing faithful. But the Lord reminded him. He said, no, there are 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. You know, look, dear friends, I know that there's troubles in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I understand there's problems. But don't let that cause you to reach a point in your life where you believe the church is now Babylon. Don't let the devil take you down that path. There are still in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, despite all its failings, those who truly love God, who love the three angels' messages, who truly treasure the spirit of prophecy, and who truly embrace everything that it means to be a Seventh-day Adventist, they're there. And I pray to God that each one of us will be among those who are true-hearted, as Sister White says. She then goes on to say, their prayers of confession, penance, and faith went up without ceasing before God. He was not indifferent to their cries, but while there was apparently no response, His providence was preparing for them help suited to their condition. Now, this is a very interesting concept. So here they are, looking around, recognizing the apostasy, the corruption, the deplorable condition of God's people. They are a praying people. And they not only pray, but these people are waiting for a response. But what's interesting, God is working. While they may not realize, you know, the ultimate outcome, God's still working for them. He's preparing. And right now, dear friends, we may not realize it, but God is preparing people for these last days. And I think, just like when He called Samuel, He'll call them to come and fill the gap and be leaders in the church. And we may not know who they are until that day, but let us be faithful and continue to persevere. She goes on to say, there was not found in all of Israel a man through whom the Lord could work for the deliverance of His people. The erroneous education given to children, indulgence of appetite, and conformity to the practice of heathenism had greatly lessened both physical and moral power. And stop right there. Oh, friends, this is a strong statement. There was not to be found in all Israel a man through whom the Lord could work for the deliverance of His people. Why? She says because they received an erroneous education. They were given to the indulgence of appetite, and they were conforming to the practices of heathenism. This had a greatly lessened them both physically and morally. Did you catch that? Friends, does it matter what kind of education you give your children? You better believe it does. You better. And by the way, this is not just the education they're getting in the school system. I'm talking about, all more importantly, the education they get in their homes. Because it all starts in the home. And that's what Sister White's talking about, and we'll get into that a little later as we continue on in our subject. But it's very interesting how that it's a sad commentary. There wasn't anyone to be found. That's why Samson was brought forth. Do you realize that Samson was brought forth because God couldn't find anyone? He couldn't find anyone to fill the gap and be a leader. So God had to start from scratch. So He went to Manoah's wife and said, I'm going to give you a son, and you're going to raise him up as a Nazarene. And that boy you're going to train to be the deliverer. Now, I'm going to tell you, dear friends, that is an awesome insight when you start to think about it, that God looked around among all the children of Israel, and He couldn't find anyone because they were so perverted in their thinking, both, as she says, physically and morally, because of their false education, indulgence of appetite, and they were conforming to the practices of heathenism. Unbelievable. She then continues on. She says, godly fathers and mothers looked with gloomy forebodings to the future. Many a mother had secretly cherished the hope that she might give to God and to Israel a son who should deliver His people from the oppressor's power. But as parents saw their children coming up with perverted appetites and uncontrolled passions, the inquiry arose, what will the end be? They saw no hope on the horizon. This is among the godly. They saw no hope on the horizon. And she says, many a mother were hoping, oh Lord, let me have a child so this child could be someone that will serve and honor You and give glory to Your name. What part will these youth and children act in the great drama of life? In the hearts of many mothers, hope battled against fear. But in other hearts, reigned only discouragement and despair. What could the mother do to avert the threatened evils? How could she train her children for God? How banish the nameless terror which oppressed her soul? Spare us, O God, spare us, was the oft-repeated prayer. Let not Thy people perish. Let us not see our children a prey of the enemy. Signs of the Times, September the 15th, 1881. So these two statements, taken from the same article, very much reveal what was taking place. So when the first verse of Judges 13 says, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they were in bondage for 40 years, you can see the reason why. Great commentary from the servant of the Lord, the Spirit of Prophecy. And Brent, this is the beauty of the Spirit of Prophecy, by the way. I just want to highlight something here. I wasn't planning on doing this, but let me tell you know, just those two comments, based on, this one verse, gives you an enormous insight. It sets the groundwork. It gives you the proper perspective and context of what's to follow. And that's all because of the Spirit of Prophecy. Can't we see the importance and the beauty and just the majesty of what God has done for us? How many there are in our church who just don't believe in the inspiration of the Spirit of Prophecy is just beside me. It's very disappointing, very disappointing. But I hope that you just got a little glimpse of how beautiful the Spirit of Prophecy can be when you study it in relation to the Bible correctly. Now, as we continue on in our studies, we're looking, as I say, the life of Samuel. We're looking here at Judges 13. The next section I want to focus on is verses 2 to 7. And that is when the angel of the Lord appears to Manoah's wife with a message. Now, there's two very important things brought out in these verses. Number one, she shall have a son. In other words, God's told her, you're going to have a son. He's going to be the deliverer. But there was a stipulation given to her in regarding the education of this child. And that was the second part of the message. Instruction concerning her habits and the treatment of the child, which is a very interesting correlation. So here we have the angel of the Lord, which, by the way, we know is Jesus Christ, both from the scripture, and Sister White confirms it again several times. But nonetheless, at the time when the angel of the Lord appeared to Manoah's wife, she didn't know it was the Lord. And neither did Manoah when she came back and told him, the angel came and told and revealed to her these things. But they later did discover that it was the Lord himself. But the relation you have here is that God, when he tells Manoah's wife, you're going to have the son who will be the deliverer, but you must raise this child a certain way. And that's why he was to be raised under a Nazarite vow. Very dedicated from the time you're born. Complete and full commitment to God. But along with that, the angel of the Lord tells Manoah's wife how she is to be governed herself. Not after the child is born, but before the child is born and during the life of that child. So you see that what you're getting to, and I'll read some statements here, it really comes down to prenatal care, the importance of how all of this comes into play. But we'll talk about that in a second. And then the second section in Judges 13 is verses 8 to 14. And this is when Manoah entreats the Lord. Because remember, as I said, if you look here, let's go to Judges 13, verse 6. This is after the angel talks to Manoah's wife, and the angel of the Lord, Jesus Christ, of course, reveals to her the promised child that would come. She then goes to her husband, and this is where we pick up the story in verse 6. Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came unto me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God, very terrible. But I asked him not whence he was, neither told me he his name. And he said unto me, behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and now drink no wine nor strong drink, neither eat anything unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. And so she goes, as he says, story says, repeats the message to Manoah. Now, in verses 8 to 14, this is when Manoah entreats the Lord. And he goes, of course, he knows something's very serious has just happened. And it's during this time, that's when Manoah and his wife realize that this man of God, or angel of God, is God. It's the Lord himself. And so he starts to entreat the Lord, inquiring, and starts to, petition God at this time. Now, from verses 15 to 23, this is where you pick up again the continuation. Once the story is confirmed in Manoah's mind that what is going to happen. In verses 15 to 23, Manoah offers a burnt offering unto the angel of the Lord. And this is when, of course, this is when he realizes and discovers the angel is God. He awakens to the realization of it all. And, of course, the burnt offering is a complete sacrifice. You burn everything on the altar. It's corresponding, of course, to the Nazarite vow. But more importantly, Manoah and his wife are offering it also on behalf of themselves, more importantly. Because remember, dear friends, Samson's life is, in terms of his upbringing, is contingent on Manoah and his wife and how they are going to behave and conduct themselves. There's no doubt that already the fact that we have that Jesus Christ comes to Manoah's wife and him and says, you know, I'm going to give you the child of deliverance. They must have been, without a doubt, already a godly couple. There's no doubt about it. But God was asking for a deeper commitment, a more consecrated effort. And, you know, this was a special occasion. There was not anyone that God could rely on at that time, any male, of course, to be a deliverer. And so he had to bring forth a child. And through this child, which of course would be Samson, he would deliver them from the Philistines. So you have a very interesting relationship taking place here with Manoah and his wife, and of course the promised child and the Lord. And of course the burnt offering, as I said, represents dedication, commitment, surrendering of all. Everything was to be burnt on the burnt offering, the whole animal, everything was to be consumed. And this again signifies everything. You've got to give it all. And the parents had to rededicate themselves, recommit in their lives. And I guess, you know, you look at this and you think, well, you know, maybe you already feel you're living a good, I don't want to appear to sound like you're arrogant or anything, but maybe you think I'm living a godly life. And you may well be living a godly life. But I think there are times, such as the case we're looking at here, that even though you may be godly, God may be asking for a deeper experience, a deeper commitment. And again, I know these were special times, but I can't help but think that the times in which we live are special as well. So this is where we have the story here from verses 15 to 23. And then verses 24 to 25, of course, picks up the story where Samson is born. Now, I want to read to you something very important. And these are some statements from the servant of the Lord on the issues that I've been discussing and, or at least made reference to. And I want you to listen very carefully to these statements. The first one's going to come from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 561 to 562. The second statement is going to come from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 562. And the third, fourth, and fifth statements are going to come from Signs of the Times, September 15th, 22nd, and then the 29th of 1881. I'll repeat the references when I finish the statements. But the first one's going to come from Patriarchs and Prophets, page 561 to 562. I've entitled it Parental Responsibility. And I want you to listen to what the servant Lord says. God had an important work for the promised child of Manoah to do. And it was to secure for him the qualifications necessary for this work, that the habits of both the mother and the child were to be carefully regulated. The child will be affected for good or for evil by the habits of the mother. Stop right there. Did you hear that? The habits of the mother prior to the birth of the child will affect the outcome of that child, whether for good or for evil. Man, that is so powerful. Unbelievable. I mean, that is just awesome responsibility on the parents, especially the mother. She continues, she must, meaning the mother, she must herself be controlled by principle and must practice temperance and self-denial if she would seek for the welfare of her child. Unwise advisors will urge upon the mother the necessity of gratifying every wish and impulse. But such teaching is false and mischievous. So you're going to get people say, oh, don't be so strict. Don't be so hard. I mean, come on, the child can eat that. They can go watch this. Well, now look, you know, you got to use wisdom. You have wisdom. You got to use some discretion. But don't ever gratify every wish and impulse, as she says, of the child. No, you can't do that. She then goes on to say, the mother is, by the command of God Himself, placed under the most solemn obligation to exercise self-control. And fathers, as well as mothers, are involved in this responsibility. Both parents transmit their own characters, mental and physical, their dispositions and appetites to their children. Stop right there. Did you catch that one? Can you believe that statement? And fathers as well as mothers are involved in this responsibility. Both parents transmit their own characteristics, mental and physical, their dispositions and appetites to their children. Their own characteristics, their mental and physical, their dispositions, appetites. Man, how much responsibility there is. It's just incredible. And so this is why you see in the scripture when the Lord came to Manoah's wife and told her, of course, you're going to have a son, He emphasized first very clearly to her, you need to get your life recommitted and dedicated again. And then when the child is born, raise him up in the fear of God. So it's very, very important. She goes on to say this, as the result of parental intemperance, children often lack physical strength and mental and moral power. Liquor drinkers and tobacco users may and do transmit their insatiable craving, their inflamed blood, and irritable nerves to their children. Now, it's possible to transmit certain dispositions to your children. And, of course, science has proven this to be the case. You know, if you're a drug addict or if your wife or husband has been a drug addict, you know, depending on the nature of the drugs you take, you can transmit a certain disposition, because the problem is the child's ability to resist cravings and the temptations are much, much greater. And it's very hard for that child to come, you know, to overcome or to resist that temptation. It's very difficult. So you're giving that child a great disadvantage. But boy, I tell you, this is so important. She goes on to say, the licentious often bequeath their unholy desires and even loathsome diseases as a legacy to their offspring. And as the children have less power to resist temptation than had their parents, the tendency is for each generation to fall lower and lower. Now you can see why we're reaching a level we are today in such an immoral, demoralized society. To a great degree, parents are responsible not only for the violent passions and perverted appetites of their children, but for the infirmities of the thousands born deaf, blind, diseased, and idiotic. She says, the inquiry of every father and mother should be, what shall we do unto the child that shall be born unto us? The effect of prenatal influences has been, by many, lightly regarded. But the instructions sent from heaven to those Hebrew parents, and twice repeated in the most explicit and solemn manner, shows how this matter is looked upon by our Creator. So again, the fact that He came back twice and told them the same thing shows, again, the importance of prenatal care and the upbringing of the child. And again, by the way, both parents. It's not just the one in terms of raising that child. It's both parents. She goes on to say, and it was not enough that the promised child should receive a good legacy from the parents. This must be followed by careful training and formation of right habits. God directed that the future judge and deliverer Israel should be trained to strict temperance from infancy. He was to be a Nazarite from his birth, thus being placed under a perpetual prohibition against the use of wine or strong drink. The lessons of temperance, self-denial, and self-control are to be taught to the children even from babyhood. Patriarchs and Prophets, 561, 562. And so you see what an explosive reference there, just incredible, the parental responsibility. And again, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 562, she says this, and I've entitled it True Temperance. She goes, true temperance teaches us to dispense entirely with everything hurtful and to use judiciously that which is helpful. There are few who realize, as they should, how much their habits of diet have to do with their health, their character, their usefulness in this world, and their eternal destiny. The appetite should ever be in subjection to the moral and intellectual powers. The body should be the servant to the mind and not the mind to the body. And again, this is a very interesting statement because you have really being referenced here the lower powers and the higher powers. And of course, the higher powers being the mind, the lower powers being the appetite and passions. And unfortunately, today we are operating, in terms of societies, operating when the passions are controlling the mind, when it should be the very opposite. And this is why we have so much iniquity and corruption and morality in society today. And it's all based on the fact that there's so many are intemperate, not just in dietary habits, but in other ways as well. And again, this next statement comes from Signs of the Times, September 15, 1881. This one, of course, is entitled Prenatal Care. Picks up basically with Patriarchs and Prophets in 561, 562 in the first statement. But I want you to listen to what she says. The words uttered by the angel convey an important truth. Our Creator Himself declares that the mother's habits prior to the birth of a child will affect its character, its destiny. In speaking to this one mother, the Lord spoke to all the anxious, sorry mothers of all time, and to all the mothers of succeeding generations. Yes, every mother may now understand her duty. She may know that the character of her children will depend vastly more upon her own habits before their birth and her personal efforts after the birth than upon external advantages or disadvantages. Imagine that? Wow. If the mother would be a fit teacher for her children, she must form habits of self-denial and self-control before their birth. She imparts to them her own qualities of blood, her own strong or weak traits of character. If her ways are established in God, if she heeds the admonition which He gives, she will do her part to give right character, right temper, and right appetites to her offspring. Said the angel, let her beware. That is, be prepared to resist temptation and stand firmly at her post. Let principle control her appetites and her passions. Of every mother, it may be said, let her beware. There is something to shun, a necessity of guarding herself if she would seek eminence for the gift of God in her child. If she is unstable, double-minded, unprincipled, she will in most cases cause the future ruin of her child. Her fixed principles of action, her unbending purpose to adhere to right rules as the wisdom of God dictates, will give these same traits of character to her child. The Lord has spoken, and His words are not to be disregarded. The divine command was very explicit, prohibiting the use of the fruit of the vine. Every drop of stimulant taken by the mother as a gratification of the appetite endangers the physical, mental, and moral health of her offspring, and is a direct sin against her Creator. The accumulated misery and wickedness of our world exists in consequence of disregarding the express commands of God. The restrictions are given by the one who made man, who instituted the laws controlling his physical being, and who knows what is for his good. Dare any regard the lessons with indifference? You know, when you think about that statement, and there's a lot to chew on. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot to discuss with that one statement alone. But I'll tell you, when you start to think about it, you begin to realize that this world is in such a deplorable condition because fundamentally, all the problems originated in the home. So what we see in society is nothing more than a reflection of what happened in the home. And boy, I tell you what, dear friends, that's an incredible, incredible statement. The next statement here is from Signs of the Times, September 22 of 1881, entitled The Vast Laser of House. Fathers and mothers who gratify inclination and perverted appetite at the expense of health are not only working against their own physical life and moral advancement, but they leave their perverted appetite and their enfeebled moral power to their children. In consequence of the sinful habits of men, the world has become a vast laser house, meaning like a leper colony, full of disease. Society is demoralized, the church is cursed, and God is dishonored. That's the end result. There you go. That's our society. Signs of the Times, September 22 of 1881. She says, the violation of God's law lies at the foundation of all the misery that flesh is heir to. So why is there so much misery in this world, friends? Why? Because of the violation of God's law. She goes on to say, parents are not only responsible in most cases for the violent passions and perverted appetites of their children, but for the infirmities of the thousands born deaf and blind and idiotic. Sins of omission and of commission have brought the sure result. You know, it's one thing to willfully sin. It's not, you know, the sin of omission, the sin of commission. So it's unbelievable when you start to realize the impact and the enormity of parental responsibility, really. Next statement, Signs of the Times, September 22 of 1881. And by the way, just remember something very clearly important I want to remind you again. Look, as I said, I can't read you everything that's in these articles. Please go back and read them. Please take the time to spend going through them. There's going to be much I'm unfortunately going to have to leave out, but I ask you to please take the time to go back and read those articles. She goes on to say this in this statement. Parents who indulge appetite by eating to excess even wholesome food. Now, this is very important. It's not enough. You know, you talk, well, I don't eat anything wrong per se. I mean, everything I eat is fine. It's okay. But even excess of wholesome food place a needless tax upon the system, and their children will be disposed to self-indulgence and gluttony. The thoughts and feelings of the mother will have a powerful influence upon the legacy she gives her child. If she allows her mind to dwell upon her own feelings, if she indulges in selfishness, if she is peevish and exacting, the disposition of her child will testify to the fact. Thus, many have received a birthright, almost unconquerable tendencies to evil. Now, can you believe that? That's unbelievable. That is just unbelievable when you start to think of how important that is. Almost unconquerable tendencies to evil. All because the mother transmitted to the child all her evil traits. You know, this is something very interesting. This is a very fascinating concept. You can be born with a tendency toward a particular sin. That doesn't mean you're a sinner, and it doesn't mean you've sinned. In other words, just because you're tempted to do something, the temptation in and of itself isn't the sin. It's whether you yield to that temptation by choosing to disregard the direct light that God has given you in regard to that issue. And so you then violate the revealed will of God. And this, of course, brings guilt and condemnation. But people are born, there's no doubt, many people are, well, frankly, I don't know exactly what the ratio would be, but a good number of people, as she says, many, so I'll stay with that. Many are born with an almost unconquerable tendency to evil. That is a very strong statement. But again, just because someone has a tendency to go in a certain direction doesn't mean they have to. And it doesn't mean they have sinned. And so, in other words, it's not an excuse. Some people might say, well, you know, that's the way I was born that way. I was born to be this way, or born to, you know, to do a certain thing or behave a certain in a certain way, etc. Well, you may have, from your birth, been born with an evil or tendencies towards evil, but that doesn't mean you have to do it. It doesn't mean that it justifies the evil. So, you know, it's a very interesting concept, but some people use it as an excuse for their sins. September 22, 1881, Signs of the Times. Again, she goes on, this is another statement. This is a title that Does God Care? Many make the subject of intemperance a matter of jest. They claim that the Lord does not concern himself with such minor matters as our eating and drinking. But if the Lord had no care for these things, he would not have revealed himself to the wife of Manoah, giving her definite instructions, and twice enjoining upon her to beware lest she disregard them. Is not this sufficient evidence that he does care for these things? So God does care about our health. And people want to make light of it. People think it's just, you know, it's a minor issue. Well, it's not a minor issue. God does care. And it means so much to him. And it should mean very much to us as well. And by the way, just again, this is something obviously on this point. You know, obviously from reading thus far, we see the physical connection from the healthful habits, whether it be dietary or otherwise. So there's a direct correlation, obviously, from what you eat to your health. And there's also a direct correlation between what you do and eat and drink and your thoughts, etc., relative to the spiritual as well. So it has an enormous impact on your physical and spiritual and moral. September 22, Signs of the Times, 1881. The lack of moral worth is what I've entitled this statement. We are responsible for the good that we might have done, but failed to perform because by sinful indulgence we place ourselves in a condition of physical and mental inefficiency. We are responsible for the good that might have been done, but failed to perform, all because we were selfish, self-indulgent. She goes on to say, the cause of reform today is suffering for the want or the lack of men and women of integrity and moral worth. You believe that? Man, the lack of moral worth. God help us all to have moral courage and moral worth. Remember, friends, morality is based on what you know, the choices you make. In other words, what I mean is that, you know, Christ is the centerpiece of everything in our lives, salvation, morality, righteousness, etc. But the choices you make in life determine the type of character you form. If you want a moral character, a righteous character, then you've got to make the right choices in your life. You got to do the right thing. And finally, the last statement on this section, Signs of the Times, September 29, 1881. She says, an important missionary field is open before the mother. The humble round of duties which women have learned to regard as a wearisome task should be looked upon as a grand and noble work. It is the mother's privilege to bless the world by her influence. Now listen to this. Society is molded by the influence of the mother. Did you catch that? Society is molded by the influence of the mother. This is an important missionary field. And it, of course, it's a hard, as she said, a wearisome task. No doubt about it. It can wear you down. But the mother needs to look upon this as a grand and noble work. That she is nurturing and trying to the best of her ability to develop righteous children who will be righteous adults and bless this world. Great responsibility, an enormous, enormous responsibility. Well, in our next message, what I'm going to do is we're going to pick up on Judges 14, and we'll continue on in our study of the life of Samson. I want to again say thank you to all who have been so kind in your help and your prayers for Judy and I and the great work that you've joined in with us. And I pray that God will be kind and gracious to you in a very special way, and that the Lord will fulfill all your desires. May God bless you, and the Lord be with you.